Hello, listeners. This is Carolyn Yeager bringing you the sixth installment of my reading of the Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau, 1939 to 1945, a book written by Alfred Desaias from the surviving files of this bureau. The date is Monday, July 27, 2015. I will read chapters 11 and 12 for this program. Chapter 11 is titled Investigations of German War Crimes, but though it's 11 pages long, it doesn't amount to much, because there are no records about such investigations by the Wehrmacht Bureau except for what is contained in one existing volume. Nevertheless, author Desaias uses this chapter primarily to attack what he calls the Nazi regime and raise the specter of the final solution, the alleged extermination of the Jews, as a necessary counterweight to the crimes of the Allies. That is the subject of this book. Truthfully, after reading this chapter and the next one, for the first time in preparation for this program, I considered skipping them and had decided to, actually, but then felt it better if I faithfully read the entire book as promised, even though my listeners might get bored with all the generalizations. I don't find these two chapters to be the best in the book, for sure. I have a lot of problems with them, which I will probably mention as we go along. So let's get started. Chapter 11, Investigations of German War Crimes. The decree of 4 September 1939 gave the War Crimes Bureau authority to investigate not only enemy violations of international law, but also such accusations as are raised by foreign countries against the Wehrmacht. The surviving 226 volumes of Bureau records, however, include only a single volume on German war crimes. It is not known whether relevant records were lost or deliberately destroyed, or whether the Bureau, for whatever reason, failed to investigate other German war crimes. More important, the available records give no indication whether the members of the Bureau received any official or unofficial communications regarding the mass murders of Jews at German concentration camps or about the criminal activities of the SS in Russia. Well, you see here, ladies and gentlemen, how he is assuming, and he continues to assume, and has assumed all through, but it comes out more now, that there were mass murders of Jews in these concentration camps, as is the narrative from the Nuremberg Tribunal. And that's the narrative that is accepted as absolute fact here, and it's referred to now and then, and I'll point it out when it is, but it's referred to as it is being referred to here, just casually, as though why was it that they didn't know anything about these mass murders, about the extermination of the Jews, about the final solution. So continuing with Desaias, he writes, "It is true that the Bureau was granted no authority to investigate the activities of the SS, but even with respect to alleged crimes committed by the Wehrmacht, its competence extended only to those that were made the subject of official protests from foreign powers. For knowledge of these, the Bureau depended on communications from the German Foreign Office, which alone was authorized to respond to foreign protests submitted through the protecting power. Yet it should also be noted that the German Foreign Office and the Wehrmacht Operations Staff frequently dealt with foreign accusations directly." Now that is, the Foreign Office and the Wehrmacht Operations Staff was what Jodl was in charge of, Colonel General Jodl. So it's separate from the Wehrmacht Bureau of Judges and Lawyers. So that's what he's saying here, that without ever referring the cases to the Bureau for more thorough inquiry, he's saying it should be noted that the German Foreign Office and the Wehrmacht Operations Staff frequently dealt with foreign accusations directly without ever referring the cases to the Bureau for more thorough inquiry or even for its information in files. Alfons Waltzog, if you recall, he is one of the judges of the War Crimes Bureau that has been mentioned a number of times already. Alfons Waltzog remembers seeing a number of relevant documents that had been submitted to the High Command of the Wehrmacht and on which Field Marshal Keitel had written in his customary lilac-colored ink. quote, do not involve the WR, unquote. That is, keep the legal department and the War Crimes Bureau out of the matter. And here, Desaias has a footnote, footnote 1, and I want to refer to this because it shows that what he has written here is a little bit, he's taking liberties, I would say, with the facts to some extent. So I'm going to read the footnote 1, and it says that this comes from a statement from 14-15 January 1977 during a symposium at the University of Göttingen in Germany. And Alfons Waldzog, who he's speaking about here, was among the participants. It doesn't say that Alfons Waldzog said these words. There's no quote. There's nothing written directly from the notes of this symposium. We're not given that. But supposedly, Waldzog was at this symposium. That's all it said here. And this took place in 1977. I think that's important because it's trying to tell us that Field Marshal Keitel had written in lilac-colored ink that he didn't want the WR to be involved in any of this or that particular matter. Now, that's understandable as far as I'm concerned. I mean, it's not so bad to say that they don't need to get involved in this, that we can handle it. And the lilac-colored ink, I had to think about that. It's sort of an insult, but lilac is kind of basically a blue, and it's a soft color. So if he was using if he customarily used that color, it makes sense that it was so that what he wrote was immediately noticeable by the people who were looking over these reports, and there's lots of them. And when they saw the lilac color, they knew that it was Keitel right then. So that's why he used that color. Why would he use lilac? Well, as I said, it's a blue, basically blue with a little reddish, pinkish red added to it. So the red makes it visible. You notice it, but it doesn't stand out real loudly or real strongly, which would be an overly bold thing to do. So I think it seems like it is a pretty good solution to him using an ink color that would be instantly recognizable by all those who are looking over these reports and know that it was written by him. So Desaias continues, in fact, however, it may well be that no official diplomatic protests were ever lodged with the protecting powers Switzerland and Sweden on behalf of the Jewish population of occupied Europe. And he has a footnote too there in which he explains, he says, the author's study, meaning himself, of the records of the German Foreign Office did not reveal the existence of any such protests transmitted by the protecting power, nor did a search of the protecting power papers, which, unlike the German records, are complete. So the protecting power records of all of this are complete, and he searched through there and didn't find any protests transmitted from them to the Germans, and yet he says, it may be. He doesn't say it is for sure, which you could determine from his study of the papers of the protecting powers. No, he still has to say, it may well be that no protests were ever lodged. Well, of course, they were not lodged. This is the kind of thing that irritates me about him. It really irritates me, but I'll go on. He then says, still, the post-war historian cannot help asking whether the members of the Bureau knew what was happening in the Nazi concentration camps. Well, now here he's assuming the reality that extermination was taking place in the Nazi concentration camps. That's a given here, according to him. Then you go by, well, we have to ask whether they knew. And he says, it is hard to imagine that those whose daily work entailed investigation of crimes and atrocities did not at least hear rumors about the most unspeakable atrocity of the century. Oh, but there are no documents, personal notes, or diaries indicating any such knowledge, official or otherwise. And then he has footnote 3 to this, and he has to admit in footnote 3, Without exception, all the German military judges interviewed by the author claimed not to have known about exterminations at any of the concentration camps until after the end of the war. A few admitted hearing rumors of executions on the Eastern Front, but claimed that they had been unable to obtain corroborative evidence. Now, that's the end of his footnote. But it wasn't just the German military judges who said they didn't know anything about any exterminations in concentration camps. It was everyone. It was all the Germans, all the military, all the civilian, everybody had not heard about that unless they were listening to the propaganda that started coming out of Poland into England. But nobody knew about such a thing because there wasn't any such thing. In a normal situation, everything that Desaix has put forth here would indicate that this was not going on, what they say was going on. But of course that cannot be said because this has become a sacred narrative. And so it's true no matter what. And now we have to play like, well, we can't figure out why these people are lying. Well, we know that they have to be lying because they're saying they didn't know anything about it. And how does he handle this? Well, first he finishes this paragraph by saying, had they known, the question immediately arises, what would they or what could they have done to expose it? Here he's trying to say that under Nazi rule, they wouldn't have been able to speak out and speak about it anyway. That's what he's trying to say here. But the fact is that people didn't know about it because it wasn't going on. So the next section is headed Order Number 1. Other Germans at the Nuremberg trials tried to excuse themselves by claiming ignorance and explaining this ignorance on the grounds of Hitler's fundamental Order Number 1 with respect to the keeping of official secrets, including, of course, the Sonderbehandlung, special treatment of the Jews, and the Endlösung, final solution of the Jewish question, which was classified as a Reich secret matter of the highest level of state secrets. Führer Order Number 1, dated 11 January 1940, specified that 1. No one shall know about secret matters that do not belong to his own range of assignments. 2. No one shall learn more than he needs to fulfill the tasks assigned to him. 3. No one shall receive information earlier than is necessary for the performance of the duties assigned to him. 4. No one shall transmit to subordinate officers to any greater extent or any earlier than is avoidable for the achievement of the purpose, orders that are to be kept secret. Now here, Desaix has a footnote number 4. And this footnote says that at a certain International Military Tribunal session, Karl Hoffmann, who was a member of the Bureau from 1940 to 1944, remembers that Hitler's Order Number 1, quote, was posted in every office and it was taken seriously, unquote. And I want to say that an order like this is not unusual, that during wartime every government has rules like this about important information that could damage them if it got out. Every government does, but when the Allies have this, it's considered, well, they're protecting something noble. But when the Germans have it, it has evil purposes. I also want to say that by January 1940, Hitler already knew that information about the invasion in the West were being transmitted to the Allies, to the Dutch, and to the Belgians. So he knew already that treason was going on. And so he made this order out of necessity, because 4 times he had to change the date of the invasion into France because it had been leaked out on purpose. And these same people who were arrested in 1944 as traitors were the ones who were busy doing that already. So to go on, I'm going to skip a paragraph because it's too disgusting to me to read it. It's just nonsense. And it's not true either. So I'm going to skip this one paragraph and continue. This is Desaix again. There were, of course, visible signs of abuses against Jews, but deportation to the East was not perceived, even by the victims, as a step toward extermination. That's true. Every person high in the Nazi hierarchy appeared to have been kept ignorant of the truth. How was that done? In the spring of 1943, Henriette von Schirach, the wife of Baldur von Schirach, witnessed the deportation of Jews from Amsterdam and went to Hitler to protest. This is a well-known story. Hitler was at first silent and then told her it was none of her business. Also in the spring of 1943, Himmler was questioned by Hans Lammers, the chief of the German Chancellery, about rumors of exterminations in the East. Himmler replied that only deportations were taking place by order of the Führer. The Nuremberg proceedings and serious post-war testimonies provide further indication that senior officials in the German government may have remained unaware of the worst abuses. Nazi press secretary Hans Fritzsche, one of the three principals accused to be acquitted at Nuremberg, he was one of the three who were acquitted. So you can see, you're going to see that some of what he said he was playing up to his captors in hopes of being acquitted, and he was acquitted. He denied on the stand having had any knowledge of the exterminations, which would have been true. Of course, he had heard Allied radio broadcasts, which were not accessible to the German population. But when he inquired about these reports at the competent offices, he was assured that it was all enemy atrocity propaganda. During his interrogation of 27 June 1946, he stated that in February or March 1942, a middle-ranking SS leader of the Ukraine had written to him to report the killings of Jews by an SS unit. Fritzsche called on Gestapo Chief Reinhard Heydrich, who explained that, quote, special details of SS men had been misused on various occasions. He told me that he would have an investigation started immediately, unquote. Shortly thereafter, Fritzsche was called to military service and sent to the 6th Army in the Ukraine. There he attempted to conduct some investigations himself, but he was always told that, yes, there were some court-martial sentences. The reason for these sentences was sabotage. And then on 28 June 1946, Fritzsche stated, the German people were unaware of the mass murders of the Jews, and assertions of them were considered rumors. Reports that reached the German people from outside were officially denied again and again. The Russians, after they recaptured Kharkov, started legal proceedings during which killing by gas was mentioned for the first time. I ran to Dr. Goebbels with this report and asked him about the facts. He stated that he would have the matter investigated and would discuss it with Himmler and with Hitler. The next day he sent me a notice of denial. Dr. Goebbels explicitly informed me that the gas vans mentioned in the Russian legal proceedings were pure invention and that there was no factual proof to support it. It was not without reason that the people who operated the vans were put under the ban of strictest secrecy. If the German people had learned of these mass murders, they would certainly no longer have supported Hitler. You see, none of this makes any sense. Well, the reason that I'm going ahead and reading it is that it shows that what they say happened could not have happened because it could not have stayed quiet and that they could not keep all these secrets. And they weren't keeping all these secrets because these things weren't happening. Continuing, SS Judge Georg Morgan testified at Nuremberg. Now, we've all heard about Georg Morgan, and he's supposed to be some kind of a hero. But he's not. He lies, too, in order to save his own skin. As a matter of fact, this Georg Conrad Morgan was never indicted by the Allies, and he was used as a witness. He gave testimony, and he continued his legal career after the war and died on 4th February 1982. So this is the man, Judge Georg Conrad Morgan, who testified at Nuremberg, that three persons were charged with the extermination of the Jews. The former commissioner of the criminal police in Stuttgart, Christian Wirth, the chief of the Jewish section of the Gestapo, Adolf Eichmann, and the Auschwitz commandant, Rudolf Huss. Now that's clearly not true, because we certainly know that Rudolf Huss was not charged with the extermination of the Jews. by anybody, but supposedly the story goes, the Nuremberg story goes that Himmler told him to do it, or Himmler talked to him. The detachment organized by Wirth himself for the purpose of exterminating Jews was known as Action Reinhard and was purposely kept small. Himmler personally took the oath from its members and declared explicitly that anyone who said anything about the action would be put to death. See, now where does this come from? There's no source for any of this. Now, here's the sad thing for Mr. Desaius, that he's writing this chapter, and he's writing this book about German war crimes. I mean, it's all documented material. But when he gets to this chapter, Investigations of German War Crimes, and he feels the need to show all kinds of German war crimes that have been, that Germany has been accused of, that the Hitler government was accused of, he doesn't have any documentation. He just has reports and stories and stuff from the Nuremberg trial, which we know what that was, and the whole world knows what that was. It was a farce. So, here he is, putting all this stuff in this chapter, and it's very, very different from his other chapters, in which he's actually showing documented material. And he says, selected Jewish prisoners with connections abroad were made to write letters telling how well they were treated at Auschwitz, so as to convey the impression that these well-known people were alive and well. It appears that even much of the Gestapo did not know what was going on. For instance, see, nobody knew what was going on since nothing was going on. And this is why I have this problem with talking about it. I just can't read any more of this. It's just, I can't read it. It's just so, it's scandalous what's said here. He goes so far as to say that, you know, Hitler, it is reported, he wrote, it is reported that in April of 1945, Hitler ordered the evacuation of the remaining concentration camps so that the atrocities would not be discovered, and that he was raging for days because Buchenwald and Bergen-Belsen fell nearly intact into the hands of the horrified Allies. Oh, gosh. Now, this is, he's got a footnote 13. And it comes from a book by Sarah Gordon, who wrote a book called Hitler, the Germans, and the Jewish Question, put out by Princeton, New Jersey. And he's taking this from her book. That's disgraceful, truly disgraceful. So continuing on, I can read this paragraph because it shows that he cannot find an answer to his questions. And this is what's important. If anything is important from this chapter, that Desaius writes, yet, having recognized all this, that all the above, all the secret evil that was going on, that nobody seemed to know about, the historian still finds it unsatisfactory to explain the general inaction of the German population, and more particularly, the apparent inaction of members of the War Crimes Bureau, by the diabolus ex machina of order number one. That is, by saying that the reason for all this lack of revolt by the Germans in the face of all this murder and extermination of Jews and others was all because of order number one. Order number one that I've just talked about is what is the reason that's given for why Germans stayed quiet. But it cannot be, and Desaius recognizes that. And then he then says, it cannot be disputed that this order made it very difficult and risky to disseminate any information about the official murder of Jews, gypsies, and other victims. Moreover, it is probable that the original competence of the Bureau was curtailed by other government agencies. No, it is not probable. That's really was not the fact. But now he says, but given the magnitude of the crimes, it is not acceptable to claim that investigation of them would have fallen outside the scope of the Bureau's authority. Thus, the moral question remains unanswered. Only the discovery of additional files could shed light on the uncertainties about this aspect of the Bureau's work. Well, of course, these other files didn't even exist. You know, he's saying, well, maybe they're lost. We don't have them. In any case, they don't have the information that's necessary. And he says, the moral question remains unanswered. What is the moral question? The moral question is, as he says, why didn't the German people, why didn't even people like the Wehrmacht, War Crimes Bureau, those judges who were upright, why didn't they revolt against Hitler? Why did, if they knew about this, if they had heard about it, how could they have not heard about it? And why was everybody so accepting of what was going on? Now we go on to a section that actually has to do with the War Crimes Bureau and their work, and it is entitled German War Crimes in North Africa. The one volume of the Bureau's records dealing with the investigation of Wehrmacht war crimes concerns the North African campaign. On 15 September 1943, the Swiss legation in Berlin transmitted to the German Foreign Office an official protest of the British government alleging that on the night of 20 to 21st April 1943, three British prisoners of war had been killed by German soldiers near Jebel Jaffa Pass, and that on 30th April 1943, a German soldier had faked his willingness to surrender near Medjeslavab. It's against the conventions of war for a soldier to act like he's going to surrender and then his enemy approaches him and then he starts firing. I don't know what happened here, but that's what I would assume. The British note was forwarded by the German Foreign Office to the Auslandabwehr, which in turn wrote on 1st October 1943 asking the War Crimes Bureau, quote, to investigate the allegations and to propose an answer. Since the investigation of the facts is expected to take some time, we consider it appropriate to submit a provisional reply, unquote. Accordingly, on 8th October, the Bureau approved the following interim response. Quote, the allegations made in the note of 15 September 1943 are being examined. The investigations will take considerable time, and therefore a final response must remain open. The high command of the Wehrmacht is, however, in a position to state that German soldiers in the field have been unequivocally ordered to observe the rules of land warfare, and in particular Article 23 of the Hague Regulations, and that there is no doubt that German soldiers have acted accordingly, unquote. On the same day, the Bureau wrote to the operations staff requesting that the commander-in-chief for the North African region investigate the allegations. The request was denied on the grounds that the events described in the note cannot be verified because of the changed conditions, unquote. The British allegations were not investigated at all, but the German Foreign Office did not want to remain silent. The Bureau was therefore asked to draft an answer rejecting the allegations as, quote, highly improbable, unquote, and accusing the British in turn of war crimes in North Africa, as well as those in Dieppe, Sark, and Crete that were documented in the Bureau's files. A senior officer of the legal department of the Wehrmacht, Werner Hülle, suggests listing only such British violations as had occurred in North Africa and none from other theaters of war. Golcher rejected this suggestion on 13 January 1944. However, he considered the violations in Crete to be materially relevant, especially because the, quote, illegal ruses of war, unquote, employed by the British there were similar to those that the British were accusing the Germans of practicing in North Africa. On 9 February 1944, therefore, Golcher submitted to the German Foreign Office the draft of a note replying to the British protest. It described 9 instances of apparent British violations and also focused on British commando practices. Because of delays occasioned by the air bombardment of Berlin, the German Foreign Office did not evaluate Golcher's draft until 10 August 1944. Konrad Rüdiger, the expert for international law, endorsed Hülle's objections and disagreed with the Bureau's recommendation. He said, we consider it more appropriate to keep our response with respect to violations of international law by British soldiers as short and precise as possible, and to limit it to cases that occurred in North Africa and the Eastern Mediterranean Theater, unquote. Thereupon, Eric Albrecht, deputy chief of the legal department of the German Foreign Office, had a new draft prepared. But considering that nearly a year had elapsed since the first British protest, and that the Swiss legation in Berlin had communicated British reminders on 28 October 1943 and 16 March 1944, it is not surprising that London found the German note of 5 September 1944, transmitted by the Swiss Federal Political Department on 3 October 1944, in parentheses, both inadequate and arrogant. DLS, that's somebody's initials, of the British Foreign Office commented, "This is curious. It is clear that the Germans have not made any investigations, and I cannot imagine why, after waiting a year, they should now have decided to send this very weak reply. I do not see much point in answering it," unquote. British legal advisor Patrick Dean added, quote, "I doubt really whether at this stage of the war it is necessary on legal grounds to dispute the allegations made on page 2 of the German note, particularly as they have first been made in a reply to us by the German government," unquote. I guess it's late in 1944 and the urgency to respond to these war crimes charges is not as great as it had been. That's what I get from that. The next section is headed Repatriated Medical Personnel. Sometimes the War Crimes Bureau was asked by other government agencies to render a legal opinion on a given question of international law. On 29th March 1944, the High Command of the German Navy requested an opinion on British accusations against alleged German violations of the 1929 Geneva Prisoner of War Convention. The question at issue was the employment by Germany of repatriated German medical personnel. On 27 April 1944, Hermann Hovendick answered on behalf of the Bureau. He wrote, "If the British Foreign Minister, which was Anthony Eden, asserts that reemployment of repatriated medical personnel against Russia constitutes a serious violation of both conventions of 1929, he is no doubt in error in this generality. Indeed, according to the relevant regulations, exchanged medical personnel may be reemployed as such, that is, as non-combatants. But a broader interpretation of these regulations allowing a change of status of medical personnel in order to employ them as combatants is not permissible in the opinion of the War Crimes Bureau. It is true that the Convention for the Amelioration of the Conditions of the Wounded and Sick does not contain any provisions prohibiting the employment of repatriated medical personnel as combatants, but in the opinion of the Bureau, the Convention undoubtedly rests on the premise that non-combatants remain non-combatants and that therefore repatriated medical personnel can be employed only in medical service. It is feared that should Germany employ repatriated medical personnel as combatants, the British government would cease their repatriation. And that's the end of his statement. The jurists at the Navy High Command, however, were less restrictive in their interpretation and persevered in trying to find a way of construing the convention that would allow the redeployment of auxiliary or part-time stretcher bearers. On 5th May 1944, they submitted an argument that seems hair-splitting but gains in persuasiveness upon rereading. It said, "Foreign Minister Eden dealt in his declaration only with the redeployment of auxiliary stretcher bearers. With respect to this category of medical personnel, Article 9 of the Geneva Convention of 1929 provides that they, quote, shall enjoy the same treatment as the permanent medical personnel if they are taken prisoner while carrying out their functions," unquote. That is, as stretcher bearers. In our opinion, the if clause implies that both belligerents have freedom of choice as to how they should employ such military personnel. Thus, they can turn them into combatants at any time by removing their insignia, pursuant to the equally clear text of Article 12, Auxiliary stretcher bearers captured while carrying out their functions may not be retained by the enemy. If we should follow the view of the Bureau, then the belligerents would lose their freedom in the use of those auxiliary stretcher bearers who, without justification, are captured by the enemy and provisionally retained, and who, according to Article 12, should be returned without conditions and as soon as the war situation allows. This change in favor of one belligerent and to the detriment of others cannot, in our opinion, be deduced from the general meaning of the convention in the absence of a specific provision, such as in Article 18, Paragraph 6 of the convention. End of that statement. It would have been interesting to learn what the Bureau had to say about this line of reasoning. Unfortunately, because he was overburdened with other tasks, and because other governmental agencies were capable and competent to issue such legal opinions, Hoovendick declined to go into the matter again. He said, "The War Crimes Bureau asks that future matters dealing with purely legal questions be submitted directly to the head of the legal department of the Wehrmacht and not to the Bureau." Unquote. Apparently, the question was then submitted to the legal department of the Wehrmacht, which resulted in a general order from the High Command restricting the employment of repatriated auxiliary stretcher bearers to medical service. In a note dated 31st December 1944, the German Foreign Office so informed the Swiss Federal Political Department, quote, "The German government accordingly gives assurance that no member of the German medical service now to be repatriated will be employed in military capacity other than that which his protection under the Geneva Convention justifies." Unquote. The next section is headed Victims of German War Crimes During the Allied Invasion. Following the Allied landing in Normandy on 4 June 1944, when numerous British, Canadian, and American units reported that the Germans were taking no prisoners, it did not take long for the governments of Great Britain and the United States to appeal to the protecting power. The Swiss legation in Berlin delivered to the German Foreign Office a British note dated 1st August 1944 describing some of the incidents. Quote, "Supreme Commander of Allied Expeditionary Force received reports that after capture by German armed forces, certain Canadian officers and men had been shot. On or about June 8th, one Canadian officer and 18 other ranks met their death in the vicinity of Pavie in the department of Calvados, Normandy, at or near Chateau Audru. His Majesty's government are left in no doubt that they were willfully murdered by members of the 12th SS Panzer Division, in parentheses Hitlerjugend, 12th SS Reconnaissance Battalion by order of certain of their officers." The governments of Great Britain, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, and India demand that an immediate searching investigation be made and that those German officers and men who were responsible for this flagrant violation of laws and customs of war respecting prisoners of war be punished, and that the German government promulgate strict orders which will prevent the repetition in future of such an occurrence. Another protest note dated 7 September 1944 described an incident involving the killing of 7 Canadian soldiers at or near Meun, Normandy, on or about 17 June 1944. Long before the official diplomatic protest reached the Germans, the allegations had been extensively publicized by the press, particularly in Switzerland. For this reason, the German Foreign Office asked the Wehrmacht operations staff in July 1944 to investigate. This time, the War Crimes Bureau was informed, but not directly involved in the investigation process. Instead, the operations staff went directly to the Commander-in-Chief for the Western Theater, Field Marshal Günther von Kluge, who answered on 17 July 1944, quote, "Commander-in-Chief West does not know of any incident as notified from Bern. Since any such incident would surely have been reported, Commander-in-Chief West considers this message to be one only intended to harass, unquote. Yet the case was not dropped. Instead, the intelligence department was given the task of pursuing the investigation. The official German answer to the protests of 1st August and 7th September 1944 was not forthcoming until 31 December. It challenged the conclusions of the British Commission that investigated the killings, because neither the content of the witness testimony nor the names of the witnesses were given. Therefore, it rejected the British accusations as, quote, defamations of the Wehrmacht, unquote, asserting that the high command of the Wehrmacht had carried out thorough investigations and failed to discover wrongdoing on the German side. But the note went on to admit that, quote, the investigations of the alleged killings near Chateau Audru could not be completed because the majority of the members of the 12th SS Panzer Division had been either killed or captured in the first days of the invasion. With respect to the alleged killings near Muin, the investigations were similarly negative, since those units of the 12th SS Reconnaissance Battalion had been wiped out in the fighting on 26 July 1944. This German note was transmitted by the Swiss legation on 11 January 1943. In the meantime, however, still another British protest, dated 6 December 1944, had reached the German Foreign Office. It contained a catalog of further killings of prisoners of war involving members of the 11th SS Division, one Gestapo official, and a patrol of the 752nd Infantry Regiment. This new British note was followed by another German investigation. In February 1945, the new Commander-in-Chief West, Field Marshal Gerd von Rundstedt, reported that all SS units that had been in the area at the time had been questioned without any results. Further questioning was still being carried out among survivors of the 752nd Infantry Regiment. As to the accusation that a second lieutenant of the 272nd Battalion and an officer of the 997th Infantry Regiment had ordered their men to shoot all Allied soldiers taken prisoner, von Rundstedt reported, "The vagueness of the accusations renders investigations very difficult. Although the numbers of the regiments are given, we have no clue by which to identify the officers responsible among the company leaders and to establish whether the alleged order to kill prisoners of war was in fact given." On 28 February 1945, the German Foreign Office again consulted the Wehrmacht operations staff, but the results are unknown. In view of the impending collapse of the Reich, it is doubtful that the inquiry was actually pursued any further. The next section is headed Malmedy, which is that town or city in Belgium in which the so-called Malmedy massacre took place in 1944. On 30 December 1944, the State Department in Washington requested the Swiss legation to transmit the following protest to the German government. Quote, "A group of 15 survivors have reported that on 17 December, in the fighting south of Malmedy in Belgium, about 190 members of an American Field Artillery Observation Battalion were taken prisoner by German forces. The prisoners were stripped of their valuables and equipment, herded into a field, and submitted to machine gun fire from tanks at a range of approximately 100 feet. The note demanded that the German government investigate the killings and punish the guilty. This incident, too, had already been widely publicized in the Swiss press and promptly denied by the German government. Yet while the Foreign Office issued an official dementi, it also ordered an immediate investigation. On 1st January 1945, the IC officer at von Rundstedt's headquarters reported, quote, "Thus far, the investigations have been negative. Therefore, we believe that the accusations constitute nothing but foul enemy agitation," unquote. Interestingly enough, the inquiry was pursued even after this negative report, although the war was quickly drawing to a close. After the 1st and 2nd SS Corps and a special unit called Solar reported in the negative, a large number of American prisoners were questioned about Malmedy by a special detail for prisoner of war interrogations. Apparently, nothing came of these investigations. Yet on 29 January 1945, the operations staff wrote to Ausland Abwehr that the Malmedy investigations should by all means be continued. Quote, Commander-in-Chief West should be advised of the new order of 26 January 1945, in which the Führer expressly commands the observance of the principles of the Geneva Red Cross Convention, unquote. Although the imminent German collapse was clear to all, the German Foreign Office pursued its work routinely and submitted its official answer to the Swiss legation on 8 March 1945. Quote, the German military authorities ordered that an immediate inquiry be made as soon as they heard in enemy radio reports about the alleged shooting of 150 prisoners of war in the Malmedy area. The inquiry has established that the report is not true. Pursuant to the memorandum of the Swiss legation, new investigations were carried out by the German troops that had been engaged in the Malmedy areas during the period in question. These investigations have similarly established that the American prisoners of war have not been shot. The report that 15 so-called survivors allegedly made to the State Department is therefore false. Yet American investigations during and after the war established that 142 American soldiers had in fact been machine gunned in a field near Malmedy. Now that's not true, I would say. He thinks that because that's what the Americans said. To go on, the German units involved were easily identified after the war, and a trial against 73 former SS soldiers began on 16 May 1946 at Dachau, the former Nazi concentration camp near Munich. The accused, presenting their version of the events, claimed that the American soldiers, caught by surprise by the German armored attack, did surrender and were in the process of being sent to the rear of the German lines, but that in the confusion of the second day of the Battle of the Bulge, a new wave of German tanks apparently mistook the Americans in uniform for regular combatants. Counsel for the defense also noted that according to the testimony of some American witnesses, that no shots fell until the American soldiers started to flee. The killings were so closely related to the fighting that the case for deliberate murder was rendered somewhat tenuous. Nevertheless, on 16 July 1946, 43 of the accused received the death sentence, 30 were condemned to long prison terms. 5 years after the Nuremberg and the Dachau trials, the American military government in Germany implemented a policy of reconciliation and amnesty in the course of which the commander-in-chief of the U.S. Armed Forces in Germany, General Thomas T. Handy, reduced the sentences of many of the Malmedy convicts and changed all death sentences to life imprisonment. Without expressing a doubt about their actual guilt, General Handy explained his decision of 31st January 1951 by conceding mitigating circumstances since the killings had, quote, occurred in connection with confused, volatile, and desperate fighting, unquote. So it seems as if 5 years later, the Americans admitted that this was a confusion of war situation, but they did not actually admit it. They changed the sentences, but they never would admit. What I don't understand is how, if they received the death sentence, they wouldn't have still been alive 5 years later to have their sentences changed to life imprisonment. I don't get that at all. To balance this out, I want to add a postscript to the Malmedy alleged massacre. After word spread about the Malmedy event, at least one American unit issued orders, quote, no SS troops or paratroopers will be taken prisoner, but will be shot on sight, unquote. Author Martin Sorge writes, It was in the wake of the Malmedy incident at Chernon, that spells C-H-E-G-N-O-G-N-E, that on New Year's Day 1945, some 60 German POWs were shot in cold blood by their American guards. The guilty went unpunished. It was felt that the basis for their action was orders that no prisoners were to be taken. Unquote. An eyewitness account by John Fague, his name is spelled F-A-G-U-E, I'm pronouncing it Fague, of B Company, 21st Armored Infantry Battalion of the 11th Armored Division near Chinon, describes the killing of German prisoners by American soldiers. Quote, some of the boys had some prisoners line up. I knew they were going to shoot them, and I hated this business. They marched the prisoners back up the hill to murder them with the rest of the prisoners we had secured that morning. As we were going up the hill, out of town, I know some of our boys were lining up German prisoners in the fields on both sides of the road. There must have been 25 or 30 German boys in each group. Machine guns were being set up. These boys were to be machine gunned and murdered. We were committing the same crimes we were now accusing the Japs and Germans of doing. Going back down the road into town, I looked into the fields where the German boys had been shot. Dark, lifeless forms lay in the snow. Unquote. Joseph Cummins also relates Fague's account of the killing of about 60 prisoners, but he notes that before the execution of the POWs took place, several Germans, including unarmed medics, waving Red Cross flags, were machine gunned when trying to surrender. This particular war crime no doubt never found its way to the Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau, and so we don't find it written about in this book. In any case, we'll move on to Chapter 12, which is titled Wehrmacht Conceptions of Post-War International Law, which I think has no purpose, this chapter, and which you may agree with me after I read it to you. It's more of this idea that Desire seemed to have, that he needed to add things that made the Germans look bad. That didn't make the Germans look bad, but made the German government of Adolf Hitler look bad. So this chapter begins, to the American reader of the late 1980s, it may appear outlandish that in the early 1940s, German lawyers were planning a new codification of international law that would better correspond to German interests. To the German experts in international law in 1940-41, however, it appeared entirely likely that Germany would win the war. Accordingly, it was logical to prepare for the Teutonic Endsieg and the Pax Germanica. The lawyers in the legal department of the Wehrmacht were particularly involved in drafting new norms for the post-war period. This chapter outlines the Wehrmacht conception of a new international order under German leadership as reflected in hitherto unpublished memoranda. Now, what's in this short chapter, you will find, is nothing that is degrading of the German government, but it certainly is intended to make the Germans appear to be foolish to think that there could ever be a new order under German leadership. So the next section is headed Uses of the Investigations of the Prussian Bureau. After World War I, the vanquished Germans could hardly expect the victorious Allies to prosecute their own soldiers for such violations of the laws of war as those in the Barillon case. The Treaty of Versailles demanded only the punishment of German war criminals. Think about that. The Treaty of Versailles demanded only the punishment of German war criminals. Hence, the files of the Prussian Bureau of Investigation were never used as evidence against British or French soldiers. But the files did not entirely lose their value. They were studied by a special parliamentary committee in 1919-1927, and parts were published in the five-volume International Law During the World War. The title of that was the five-volume Völkerrecht im Weltkrieg, International Law During the World War, which caused much discussion in Germany, where memories were still relatively fresh. Well, I imagine it would. It would have caused much discussion by me, and if I were there. More importantly, perhaps, the files of the Russian Bureau were used in the training of military judges. A number of particularly complex cases were adapted to teach young judges how to evaluate difficult situations on the basis of previous experience. Shortly before the outbreak of World War II, as the imminence of actual conflict grew apparent, the legal department of the Wehrmacht had a list of cases elaborated for submission to military judges and legal advisors of the military commanders. Quote, "We have purposely chosen a number of cases, the solution of which is not entirely without problems," unquote. The teaching materials included alternative solutions to 9 Francs-Tireurs or partisan cases, 5 cases involving wounded and medical personnel, 3 on the determination of prisoner of war status and its cessation, 2 on espionage, 1 on the taking of hostages, and 3 on military necessity or emergency. The materials were discussed at a conference on 26 June 1939, which was chaired by Rudolf Lehman and attended by numerous Army, Navy, and Air Force judges, as well as members of the Foreign Affairs Bureau and the Wehrmacht Propaganda Department. Also examined were cases involving reprisals and the use of dum-dum munitions. One of these concerned an order given by French General Guillemot on 8 February 1918. This is General Guillemot saying this, quote, "The division commander has been informed that a kind of tacit agreement between our front troops and the enemy appears to be practiced with respect to the transportation of the wounded after battle. The 69th Infantry Regiment reported on 5th February that a troop of 7 Germans moved under the protection of the Red Cross flag from the woods of La Pazie to Beaumont. Nothing was reported about an attack upon this important objective. This practice must cease. The division commander orders expressly that every German, regardless where and when, even those engaged in transporting wounded, must be immediately taken under fire," unquote. That's the French for you. That's typical of the French. The participants at the conference agreed with Lehman that the lower ranks should not be punished for obeying such an order because, quote, "the violations cannot be seen as the individual acts of enemy soldiers, but as acts of the enemy state. Settlement of the injustice is conceivable only by way of reprisal," unquote. The only thing you can do about that is to do the same thing they're doing, and then that leads to a very unpleasant an undesirable situation, and that's why they have conventions of the laws of war to prevent things like this. Continuing, now this is one of the worst sentences that I've come across so far in this book, but I'm going to have to read it. Desaius finishes up this section by saying, "Within a few months after this conference, Hitler unleashed World War II, and the War Crimes Bureau, as the Prussian Bureau's successor, assumed the task of studying the application of international law to concrete situations in armed conflict." This is completely inaccurate that Hitler unleashed World War II. As we all know, the ones who unleashed World War II were Churchill and his faction in the British government and Roosevelt pushing from behind, and the Poles too, and the Polish government who went along with the whole situation. This next section is titled The Gladisch Committee. What would the laws of war have looked like if Hitler had won? In the summer of 1940, when Germany expected to win, Field Marshal Wilhelm Keitel, as head of the Wehrmacht, ordered the establishment of a special committee to formulate the laws of war in a way more keeping with the long-term interests of Greater Germany. Keitel appointed this committee on 14 August 1940, under Admiral Walter Gladisch, and laid down its tasks as followed. Quote, "The moment of the restoration of the peace will give us an opportunity to attain the recognition through all states and thereby the binding force of those norms of the laws of war that have been particularly advantageous for us in this war. The moment appears to be the most propitious for perfecting the laws of war, since Germany's might will then be greatest and thus will prevail in having such norms adopted as further its interests. Moreover, the war experiences of the immediate past can be best evaluated now. Although not directly involved in the committee's drafting assignment, the War Crimes Bureau, as collecting center for matters of violations of the laws of war, received a copy of the Gladish Report of 3 December 1940. Its introduction presents a dry, positivistic view. It read, "Conventions in international law are the reflection of the political power constellation. The interests of those states strongest on land and sea and in the air determined the structure of hitherto applicable principles for the waging of land, naval, and air warfare. In substantial fields, they fail to correspond with German interests, especially in those where Germany could not throw enough weight on the scales at the time of codification. This is most obvious in the law of naval warfare, which represents primarily British interests. The current war gives reason to expect revolutionary changes in the strategic state of affairs and a shift of power in all fields of warfare. These changes must be reflected in the future laws of war. Germany will be able to demand at the end of the war a new law that takes into account its own and the continent's interests, and as speaker for a united Europe, it shall prevail. A convention that sets up rules of warfare with binding force for all states, including for the first time binding rules for air warfare, is a political goal that promises to be of service to German military interests. Such a convention must take into account the newest experiences, especially in this war, and those provisions which, through military and economic development, have been rendered obsolete or impractical, must be eliminated. The demands to be made by Germany at the end of the war must, in the meantime, be delimited. The laws of war may not be so extreme as to make the waging of war by a state impossible. Nor may neutrality legislation be so restrictive that a state would prefer to enter a war rather than preserve its neutrality. Every provision in international law which does not observe these limits will find no voluntary recognition among the majority of states and thus will not serve German interests, being applicable only in such places and at such times as Germany could enforce it. Practically, it would be no better than the absence of all law. Germany, even in its greatest deployment of power, is interested neither in a dictated international law nor in a state of anarchy in international law." End of that statement. The next section in this Gladish report deals with the political state of affairs expected to prevail at the conclusion of hostilities. It says, "We assume a peace following victory by Germany." That's what they're assuming in making up this report. The hypothetical situation can be characterized as follows. Germany stands at the head of a European bloc of states in which England is not a part. Germany has colonies in Africa and naval bases in the Atlantic and a sufficiently powerful war fleet as well as a commercial fleet. As possible enemies, we must consider England and the United States, and secondarily Russia. Pursuant to this hypothesis, Germany could be confronted by a constellation of powers over which it is not so overwhelmingly superior as to be able to afford a complete absence of commitment with respect to the laws of war. Moreover, it is probable that there will be strong neutral states that would have to be taken into account in drafting a new law of war." Unquote. The Gladish Committee went on to formulate a long list of topics to be evaluated by a larger commission. Among other points, its members considered whether Article 2 of the Hague Regulations of 1907 with respect to the levy en masse should not be changed. The levy en masse refers to the inhabitants of a territory which has not been occupied, who on the approach of the enemy spontaneously take up arms to resist the invading troops without having had time to organize themselves in accordance with Article 1. And they shall be regarded as belligerents if they carry arms openly and if they respect the laws and customs of war. Well, that is, of course, if they have to defend their own territory suddenly without having been organized ahead of time, they are not considered to be partisans, but they can be considered to be legitimate belligerents, that is, legitimate troops. But it's saying that they question whether it should not be changed. They proposed to forbid the use of colonial troops in Europe, to clearly define the criminal jurisdiction of the occupying power over the population of occupied territory, to declare the arming of commercial ships illegal, to place rescue aircraft under the protection of the Red Cross, and to define the military character of paratroops and infantry transported by air. The final section is headed Other Memoranda. Rudolf Lehmann issued a memorandum on 2 September 1940 in which he discussed the legal lesson to be learned from the Wehrmacht's war experience to that point. He said, "Investigations have shown that French authorities have violated the provisions of the Geneva Conventions in ways that make prosecution difficult or impossible. In countless cases, they fail to provide medical attention to the wounded or to take adequate measures to assure the feeding and decent quartering of prisoners of war. These acts of omission can be traced to a deliberate disregard of obligations that had been assumed. It is clear that these French omissions cannot be punished under German law. Similarly, it is doubtful whether they can be brought within the scope of French criminal provisions. Thus, it should be considered whether it would be advisable to introduce special penal norms to enable punishing serious violations of international law in Germany and also by the French government." End of Lehmann's statement. He concluded, however, that for the time being no such special legislation should be drafted for fear that England would do likewise. He said, quote, "Since we do not expect objective application of such penal provisions on the part of the enemy, this may endanger our submarine and air crews. Thus, it would not be advisable to create a new penal sanction for violations of international law," unquote. The extant Bureau files reveal no subsequent memoranda on the further development of international law. On 28 April 1942, however, Ausland Abwehr made its proposal for the systematic study of war diaries, stressing the compilation of material relevant to international law. Ausland Abwehr wrote this, "After the future conclusion of the peace, when relations between nations become more normal, international law will also experience new impulses. It is to be expected that Germany will play a leading role. Would it not be appropriate to start compiling wartime events of which international law is affected in some way and to evaluate this material with a view toward formulating a future international legal order? We should consider, for instance, the war methods employed by the Russians that were and are very far from an open and honorable way of fighting. Surely all three sections of the Wehrmacht have already begun collecting the most important events as material for a future international law. It is doubtful whether the war diaries are also being consulted. It would appear worthwhile to consider doing so." End of that statement. The War Crimes Bureau took up this recommendation and wrote the Army, Navy, and Air Force legal departments to send in all reports that could be considered valuable additions to the other materials already at the center. The events described in war diaries, quote, "could be of great value at the end of the war in formulating new principles of international law," unquote. Germany's reversals from 1942 on, however, rendered this projected use of both war diaries and the Bureau's investigations irrelevant, if not illusory. Still, the existence of such memoranda reveals much about the mentality of those lawyers in the legal department of the Wehrmacht who were responsible for the evaluation of reported cases of Allied war crimes. The chapters in Part 2 of this book illustrate how they investigated and analyzed specific cases or complexes. That's the end of Chapter 12, and I think that Desaius is indicating here that he holds the Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau judges in high esteem, and here he's saying that what they have written shows their mentality. And he seems to want to separate them from other more pro-Nazi elements in the Germany of that period. But, well, that's his thing. That's what he does. Next time, we'll begin part two, which is called Specific Cases. And we'll begin with chapter 13 on Poland. This has been Carolyn Jaeger reading from the Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau on July 27th, 2015. Until next time.